Sly Dog Music Cast. Now here's your host, the Sly Dog.
Hello and welcome back to the Sly Dog Music Cast. I'm your host, the Sly Dog, and today we have a returning guest. I've introduced this man many ways, but this will certainly be a first. Ladies and gentlemen, Craig Smith! Craig Smith! Craig Smith! Craig Smith, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I gotta tell you, first of all, I didn't know you owned bass or played bass, even though it is just an open E string, but still. And my original plan was to have the acoustic guitar and do Doug! But you beat me to it. So I thought that if I had the guitar out, you'd know. So I was like, but I'm glad that you went with it. Boy, we're two obvious motherfuckers, aren't we?
Yeah. Oh, man. Like, I always joke that I borrowed a lot of ideas from you guys, and then I was like, oh, I should, like, the bass is right there. I can just grab that and do an intro.
That's pretty funny. You're the Mike Gordon of this podcast.
Absolutely. Well, welcome back, man.
Thank you.
This has been an episode I was not expecting to do, but I have to say your enthusiasm for the subject and the fact that you've pulled me into the world of fish has made this possible. Today we're going to talk about a very exciting event in fishery, I think we can call it. Fish played Gamehenge for the first time in a while. And for those of you that don't understand what that means or the significance of it, we're going to get into all of that today. But starting at the beginning, we got to do origin stories as always. Craig, how'd you get into fish?
Okay. How much time we got? You have an out at 5 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
First of all, I just want to say to anybody who's kind of talking, listen to the beginning of this episode, who's not into fish, I do think that fish is a topic. Before I was a fan, I found it very, very, very interesting. Fact that they did this, which, you know, won't make sense to a lot of people, and I can't really think of parallels with other bands that would completely equal to what Fish did this New Year's. So it's not, I don't think you need to be a Fish fan. I think you just need to be a fan of music to appreciate at least what we talk about in the beginning of this episode. So before we get into the track by track, just the fan service is kind of like, it's a negative term, but in this case, you know, Fish is a band that loves to play pranks on the audience, have jokes for Halloween and New Year's and all kinds of stuff like that. And I always found that intriguing, even when I didn't like the music, but it was maybe the best thing that I've ever seen a band do for an audience that may or may not have expected it. So, I tried unsuccessfully to get into Fish at least two times before I finally did. In 1994, as a Beatles fan, I saw that they covered the White Album for their first Halloween show. They do, when they do Halloween shows, they do a Halloween costume where they cover an album in its entirety. Usually a surprise. When you go there, you're given a Fish bill, like a playbill that's got usually the album cover with their faces airbrushed in or something like that. And the first one was the White Album. And as a Beatles fan, I saw a bootleg of it at a local store for like $50. You know, that's what bootleg CDs went for in the mid 90s.
Wow.
And I got it home and I was like, this is complete shit. Like it's a band who learned how to play this entire album on short notice and it shows, but that's kind of, Fish is kind of just like a party band. You know, when they do covers, they're usually not doing a very faithful rendition arrangement wise. They're doing a jam band version of a song. And I've come to love the White Album for all its flaws and everything, their version of it. At that time, it didn't do anything for me. The first stoner I ever met in my life, I was straight edge for many, many, many years. I worked overnights, 12-hour shifts with a stoner, which was fantastic. because he would just philosophize all night. It was so great. And he was a big fish guy. And when we worked together, we would usually go out for breakfast on the way home after working overnight. And he would play me some fish in the car. I remember specifically hearing Reba and bouncing around the room. He had a live one in the car.
Ah.
And I was like, I don't know. I was like, I want to get into this. Like, I'm interested. Like, I'm halfway there. But the music just, there's something about it that is keeping me from jumping in anymore. So it sat on the back burner. But I'd go to like bookstores and see these crazy books on fish. They would put out these books called Farmer's Almanac, which were made by fans. And it was just all the set lists, but like these crazy stats, like every song listed, how many times it opened, what song followed it every time it was played, what came before it, how many times each year. And it was broken down in the way that like great musical websites are. It's the reason that I wanted to put, I work on a Monkees website that's a discography which tracks all of their mixes, and there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them. And it was seeing this fish stuff that really inspired me to do that. Like this, in a volume, it's so massive and it's so overwhelming that even if you don't enjoy it, you can look at it and be like, this is a glorious waste of time. Just like the amount of work that goes into this. And fish.net online is the online version of that. So I'd always been just admiring from far, and I knew all these crazy song titles, didn't know the songs, and just, you know, whatever. I would often like visit fish.net, like if something happened that I heard was cool. And then there was a podcast called Analyze Fish, which was started by Harris Whittles, who was a writer on Parks and Recreation. He's no longer with us, sadly. And his co-host was Scott Aukerman of Comedy Bang Bang. And Harris was a fish-loving stoner who was trying to convince Scott that fish was good. It usually went very badly, as you know these things do if you're introducing somebody to something that they really have no interest in. But at work, I would listen to these podcasts, and I often, you know, revisit podcasts. And there was a point where I turned to my coworker who introduced me to the podcast, and I was like, I think they got me in. I think I want to go to a fish show. And he was like, if you do, I'm there with you. And 2 years later, there we were. And it took a lot of time and a lot of listening. My first fish show was confusing. It was a lot of stuff I didn't know. But once you've put the time in and you know the entire catalog, the fish show is the greatest show you can go to. I have no doubt in my mind about that. I've seen hundreds and hundreds of concerts with bands that I've loved more than Fish at a certain point. And Fish blew all of them away with just a light show and jamming, which is a smaller part of the set list than you might think. So it was interesting to me when I started to talk to you about Fish, because Fish friends are very hard to come by. They're a very tough band to sell on people. And in fact, I started dating my girlfriend Megan almost 10 years ago. When we met, I had just gotten one of the Fish books, 800-page thing.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I need to tell you something. And I was like nervous about it. I was like, I don't know if you're going to look on me negatively about this, but I think I'm getting into Fish and this might be a thing. And she's like, I'm absolutely fine with that. She had like a fish friend that was like giving her like song titles, like say something about like Bowie, say something about like Stash. And I was like, I found my lifelong relationship right here. A woman who's fine with me being into fish. Fantastic. And there's just been so many over the last 10 years, particularly during the pandemic, from the pandemic on, just what they have put out there has been nothing short of amazing for a band of 60-year-old dudes who, you know, are playing songs that they, a lot of songs that they wrote when they were 20, which is what we'll be talking about here. But that's kind of where I come in.
That's awesome. It's interesting you mentioned that when we started talking about it, because I kind of came in without that bias. I came in strictly through like you guys, you and your buddy. I'm blank on the name. Is it Rob? Yeah, you and Rob did
Rob Grable.
did Wikipod Groove. I found those episodes just going through the Pods and Sods feed and just started checking them out. And the band just sounded interesting, and I couldn't understand why there was that stink about them, or that air of like, like you felt like you had to warn Megan, like, hey, I'm getting into Phish. Like, I didn't understand it, but it made me curious about the band. So I would always see their stuff at UCD stores. So I remember I grabbed Hoist, I grabbed Farmhouse, and Big Boat. I grabbed Big Boat. And I just fell in love with Big Boat and Hoist in particular. Farmhouse is not one of my favorites, but there's some really good stuff on there. But I really fell in love with the music, so I just kind of decided like, well, I don't have time to listen to every show, but there's plenty of records here to listen to, so why not get those? So that's what I did, and I really enjoyed them. Like, there's a lot in there. They can do a lot of different styles. They're meat and bread, basically, meat and potatoes. That's the first phrase I'm looking for. Seems to kind of be like funk rock type of stuff, but they can kind of run the gamut a little bit. They're a lot of fun. Their lyrics are a little silly, and they're great musicians. I think Trey is a wonderful guitar player. I think Paige
That's Alex.
is a great piano player,
Yeah.
absolutely amazing. So I just didn't get like the negativity. So I hopped in. I hopped in and we started talking about Phish, and we even did a Phish live stream together during the pandemic, if you'll remember. That was a lot of fun.
Yep, I do. I do remember it.
I just kind of like kept up with them as like what they were doing. Like, you certainly, like, just through your social media posts, kind of keep me interested in what's going on, even if I'm not listening to every show. I'm always curious what they're up to because they're always doing something interesting. Like, doesn't matter. So when we get to New Year's Eve, New Year's Eve, I'm watching the Taylor Swift concert, the Eras Tour. I'm watching that, and I figured you're watching whatever Phish is doing on the live stream. And I'm kind of looking in on your social media every so often. And I'm like, I just got this vibe that something really big was happening. And then the next morning, sure enough, it's like, oh my God, they did Gamehenge. No, and even I, just my basic level of knowledge, knowing what that is, was kind of like, what? Like, they did what? Like no. I was like, even I was like, no, there's no way. But then I started looking into it. I was like, son of a bitch, it happened. And you were just over the moon about it. You were like so happy.
If Megan was able to stick with me that night, then we're good because I was a mess. Can we rewind back to last New Year's?
Yeah, let's do that.
To give a little bit of context, first I'll describe briefly what Gamehenge is. Gamehenge is a fictional universe. This is going to sound very Harry Potter. I don't even know if that's in a different universe. I guess it's not. I don't know. I know nothing about it. But essentially, Gamehenge is a place where a bunch of songs take place. The Man Who Stepped Into Yesterday is a collection of songs that Trey Anastasio, lead guitarist and primary songwriter in Phish, put together to for his senior thesis. It is a combination cassette which features Phish on the music and some crazy narration by Trey, who's doing his best 1988 ASMR voice, which is fantastic. And so it was that plus a paper which he wrote, which described exactly what he was going for in some of the songs and the chord progressions in some of the songs and how he uses these chords to get to these points and minor major thirds and just the kind of shit that I love. And I read that before I got into Phish, just as a guy who like craves that kind of like tale. So essentially, The Man Who Stepped Into Yesterday is a group of songs with narration that tell a story. They performed it first in 1988. The date is not completely clear. We believe it's the first. It's at least the first documented version of it. And up until New Year's Eve, they'd only performed it 5 times. throughout once in 88, or I'm sorry, yeah, five times. 88, 91, 93, and then twice in 94, and then never again. So it's kind of been a thing that's been in, it was probably the greatest, like, when they ever drop this, if they do, people are going to lose their fucking minds. Because it's now, we're now 29 years after they've last done it. So putting that aside, New Year's Eve, there's usually some kind of presentation or gag. And they do something different every year. In 2013, it was the closest we got to a Gamehenge. There was a video shown before the main, or the, one of the middle sets, I guess it was the second set, where Fish, John Fishman, the drummer, we should also say Mike Gordon is on bass and Paige McConnell is on keyboard,
yep,
amongst the best at what they do. Just all incredible musicians. They showed a video of John Fishman going in the woods and everything, finding their old tour bus. It still had cassettes in it and just, like, you know, left there for years. So he goes in and he starts it up. He gets it going and he, like, you know, plows into a bridge and the whole top comes off it and just all this shit. And it's the defying thing. But the video leads into the actual truck driving into the audience from the backside of the stage where they parked and got on the roof of the truck and performed songs, their earliest songs. I would say 75% of those were songs around Gamehenge. And they played with the microphones taped to hockey sticks like they did in clubs in the 80s. And it was, Fish had a real bad hiatus. They broke up permanently, quote unquote, in 2004. And then a few years later, Trey was busted for driving under the influence. He went through drug court, which was another thing that kind of, I don't know that I ever would have gotten into them if they always were the crazy, heady, druggy band. Maybe I would have. But when he got clean, I was like, well, for that guy. Like, and it started to, like, maybe ease up some of my preconceived notions about who this band was. And so, like, Rob, you know, he had tickets to see what was supposed to be their final show in 2004, which was a disaster. And he sold his tickets and, like, gave up Fish. And they reunited in 2009. And it was this show in 2013 that he heard about. And he's like, oh, shit, I'm jumping back in. Just complete, you know, absolutely for the fans. Amazing thing they did. So that's the closest we got. So last year, 2022 into 2023, they did for their 40th anniversary, kind of just like a whole bunch of songs that referenced past events, and they recreated like some of the things that happened. There was one very famous naked guy at one of their shows running across the field or whatever, and he's legendary. He's also now passed. But they had a bunch of people in, like, naked body suits, you know, doing dances around Trey. And just, like, stuff like that. They did Bohemian Rhapsody, which is something they did in 96 and never again. So it was just, like, these little bits of things that they were just, like, you know, the whole premise was that they had a time machine. And the time machine breaks. So they start jumping around from era to era. So it really left, you know, what they were going to do this year, because 83 was when they formed. And so, you know, 2023 is really the anniversary. So it was, what are they going to do this year? I was a little out of the loop because I worked for a retail company and holidays are horrific. So, like, I wasn't even paying attention. Shows were coming up. I knew I was going to get the live stream on New Year's, because I always do. And Megan and I watch it. And so there were rumors about Gamehenge. I was talking to Rob, and he didn't have tickets to go that night. He went to, he did four shows at Madison Square Garden. And he didn't have tickets for New Year's, but he had tickets for a previous show. And he said to me something like, if they end up doing Gamehenge, I'm just going to have to live with it. And I kind of just laughed it off, because Gamehenge is always, always a rumor. Like, I didn't even... Right. put any weight into, well, I guess this is really the 40th anniversary, because I was like, they celebrated it last year. It's going to be something different this year. And I saw some Reddit threads that were like, I know why Game Hand is a lock, or spoiler in this thread, I know for sure what it's going to be. And so people knew, but I went into it really not knowing or thinking it was going to happen. So I think there's a way we should get into this. We should probably talk about the song Harpua, but were you going to bring something up?
Yeah, I wanted to before we dived into that. Like, I want to trace back to something. And by the way, like that.
Sorry, I was just steamrolling.
That was wonderful. By the way, I love the 2013 thing. I might have to look into, because that sounds like. Just like we're gonna commit to the bit so much, we're gonna tape mics to fucking hockey sticks. That's fucking cool. I love it.
And it's on, if you go to their official channel, it's on there. From the moment, it's got the entire film of Fish, and then going into the second set, and I think it's most of the second set, if not all of it. So, and the official Fish YouTube channel is fantastic. They put up a song from every show now, but they would put up a few shows from, or a song from every show. They would put a few songs from every leg of the tour up, like a couple nights after the show. So there's a bunch of stuff on there. If anybody is curious to just dive in and want to see some video. And if you don't like the music, you'll love the fucking lights.
It's
the best light show on the planet.
It's amazing. Yeah, some of the shit, we'll get into that later too. Some of the shit the Light Show was doing during Game Hinge is just unreal. But you mentioned something that you and I both talked about wanting to mention. Do you think, like, what do you think it is that keeps people away from this band? Like, why do you think that? Because I still don't fully understand it myself. Do you think it is the connection to, like, it's a quote unquote drug band, or is it people just don't have the patience to sit through like 20-minute jams, or like what? Because I myself really don't understand it. I listen to Fish and I hear a tight band that can play good music. I think there are songs that would, like, you could put on rock radio, like Sample in a Jar. You could put that on classic rock radio and no one would blink, as long as you didn't say it was Fish.
Yeah, no, I agree. Down with Disease. They have a lot of radio friendly shorter songs, and their albums are, you know, their albums are not full of 20-minute songs.
Right. You usually get maybe
they do one. Have.
One or two epics, maybe, album, maybe, yeah,
maybe. But even if they do, it usually the songs they have that are that long are composed. Like usually a jam vehicle at a show might be like a 3-minute song, and then they veer into 10 minutes of jamming or whatever. But they also have songs that are like multi-part that are always the same or deviate very slightly, and they're just like epic songs. I think it's a few things. I think it's the drug thing. I mean, in the 90s, I always looked at them as that drug band. Also, one of our fellow podcasters, when I was getting into Fish, said, you know, they're just Grateful Dead hippie bullshit, which I don't think is fair. They were very influenced by the Grateful Dead, but I don't think they sound anything like them. I've often said that if we're going to draw a line to anybody in terms of what they sound like, when we're putting like the poppy songs or the radio friendly bite-sized songs aside, I think their closest influence is Zappa, just in terms of music, like they jumping from keys to different keys. And that's the kind of stuff I find fascinating. I don't feel like, and that was another argument that I had, like in the beginning, I was like, they're just masters at what they do. And it's like, well, just because they play diminished chords doesn't mean that, well no, but they're composing things in the right spot. Like there's no Fish song that I listen to and I'm like, that was thrown in there. Just actually there are little bits, and I'll get into one because it's in Game Hinge, but just there, Trey in particular, his knowledge of music and looking at the paper he wrote for The Man Who Stepped In Me Yesterday, just looking at how he describes the chord voicings and harmonies and all that stuff, like that dude's a master. That thing ends with like his handwritten musical notation, which is just fantastic. You can't say they're not talented. The one thing that might be off, there are a couple things. In terms of off-putting, sometimes you'll get a strange chord, which was something that was actually brought up on the Analyze Fish podcast by somebody who was a fish denier. And I get that. I get it. When I first started listening to fish, I was not really into any of their voices. I think that's an acquired taste. I think Harris said it best on the Analyze Fish podcast. Like Trey is not, he's gotten he's like taken vocal lessons in his older age, had a little more vibrato now that he didn't have before. But the way he said it, I thought was perfect. Like Trey's voice is just like a warm blanket you wrap yourself in. And I find that exactly the case. Paige, I thought when I first started listening, I thought he was very Weird Al sounding. I couldn't just like the nasal kind of his pitch, just where it is. And it's faint. It's not, he's not up there, singing My Bologna, but it's noticeable. Fishman as a backing vocalist is competent. His lead vocals can sometimes be lacking. And Mike, it depends on the song. I've learned to, and I think this is the other part of it. If a band you love that you've listened to forever puts on a show and they decide to veer from a song you love into a section you've never heard and into wherever. This was kind of my problem with Fish in the beginning. Like, I did not love the jams. I loved the songs, and I still do. I think the songs are fantastic. I
Oh,
don't
yeah.
need the jams. I don't need the
Absolutely.
jams. And
Absolutely.
there are Fish fans that are the complete opposite, that are like, if you're giving me a show, like there are Fish fans that will absolutely be pissed at like a first set that's like, 10 really strong songs that don't jam. The
They're
Fish
so
fan,
good,
like,
though.
they are. The Fish fan craves, and I've gotten to this point where I do too, craves like the 5-song second set where they just play straight through without stopping, melding one song into another, going all kinds of places. And those are fantastic. Rob actually got me into doing something which I love, which is when I listen to a new Fish show, they release archival shows fairly often, every few months. I don't look at the set list. I just listen to the show like I'm at the show. And to be completely surprised by what happens. The one thing that was lacking during my first show, aside from the song selection, I got a bunch of songs I didn't know, but I also was not completely sure where the song ended and where the jam begins. It's not always obvious. Like I said, there are songs they've written that are 12 minutes long that are all those 12 minutes are composed in the same every time.
Where?
When you know the catalog, it's I'm going to use a pot reference here. And I hate to do it on a fish episode, but also pot is legal in my state, so I can do that. But it's kind of like for anybody that's ever indulged in cannabis. Which is not something I do when I listen to Fish. I love it sober, which is why I feel like I can talk about this. There's a point often if you're high where you feel it take off. You know that you're now moving into, whatever this altered state is. And they do that musically. I feel it without being under the influence of anything. When they hit that point where they're supposed to turn back and they keep going, I actually feel the song taking off. And it's that kind of thing. And I think others probably feel, I've never vocalized this to anybody, but that's exactly what it is to me. And it was at that moment when that clicked that the jams made sense to me. It was like, oh, they're taking me on an alternate journey with this. And it's one of when they do it well, and look, they're improvising 25% of the show. Sometimes they fall flat, but they're taking a huge risk doing it.
Right.
And when they do it amazingly, and segue into something that wasn't planned, it's fed, like they don't work out a set list. Sometimes you'll see Trey talking to a mic that's in their monitors if he's got something he wants to go into. And they might have some ideas of things they want to do, but they won't write out a set list. So like all that stuff, I just find completely, they haven't since the 90s, I believe. In fact, if you watch any of the shows on Live Fish, oftentimes, even if they have an idea of what they want to do when they get out there, Trey changes his mind and you see him walk over to all three of them and whisper something in their ear, and then they're off in the fluff head or something, you know? So, it's just one of the other things.
Even like you sent me some getting ready for this, you were talking about the song Carini, and you sent me something from the show you saw this summer. And there's a moment like right before they go into the song where like you told me like usually Carini it starts a certain way, but then Trey just gets this like look on his face where he like just does the riff and stares back at
Yeah.
John, and the song just takes off. So I love that. I love.
See, you see how excited Fishman is. Like once Trey hits that riff, you see him, he kind of like he jumps and then he's like, and he just starts banging on the fucking drums.
Oh, so
Yeah,
good.
it's so great. So it's kind of like that. And just the fact that I could look up all the set lists, all 2,000 shows that they've played, and go see them tonight and not know what I'm gonna get. And that was the great thing about seeing them. I got two amazing shows this summer with, you know, out of a catalog of, you know, thousands plus, 1,000 plus songs they've played in their career. And they usually do at least like over 100 on a tour. The chances you're going to get what you want are pretty slim. And I scored huge those two nights. So for having only three shows under my belt, I did pretty good with the last two. So, yeah, but I think that's what it is. I think it's the, because Grateful Dead was that band when I was a kid, like, you know, your uncle would like the Grateful Dead, and then your straight edge father or, you know, whoever was like, yeah, that's hippie bullshit. And that obviously went down generations to, you know, for their children to say about Fish. So I think that's what it is. But, and the other thing is, when Jerry Garcia died, Fish inherited a lot of those fans, and the lot scene became a thing, where sometimes there is some nefarious stuff happening. And I was actually reading, one of the best gifts I ever got. My sister and Megan went in on the first Farmer's Almanac, which is small. It's from 95 or 96, I believe. And the reason I wanted it was because I wanted to like read period pieces about these shows. These were back in the days when you would like give you know, cassette tape trading, which I was into in the 90s. I was a No Doubt tape trader, started a website for them, and a lot of the stuff that I recorded or traded is like out there now still. And I remember actually somebody gave me Fish Quadrophenia in 1995 for a No Doubt show, and I never listened to it. There were actually Fish CDs I bought in the 90s because I liked the packaging. Put them on, listen to a song. I was like, yeah, I don't like their version of Getting Jiggy With It. I'm never going to listen to this again.
Didn't you do that with like
So yeah, I think that's
Hampton
what it
Comes
is.
Alive? Did you do that with Hampton Comes Alive,
It
which is like
was happening.
this like
Was.
big box
No,
thing?
it's small, but it's magnetic, and both sides come out. And then the discs inside form a little, you know, like a larger version of the cover, but it's regular CD size. Yeah. So I really think that's all it is. I think that they unfairly got some of the Grateful Dead stuff. Without that, who knows? They might have been spin doctors, you know, who, you know, a jam band that I never even realized was a jam band. But they're kind of in that same pocket in the 90s. So I
Or
think that's what it is. But like, yeah, God.
Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, same kind of thing. Trey's played with Dave, quite a few times. Dave came out and played with Fish, fairly within the last year or two. So yeah. So I think that's what it is. But I so yeah, if I mean, I'm not going to say it doesn't take time. I don't know. I mean, you would be a better Well, one of the things I think is interesting is that you're a fan of the Phish albums that you've listened to. That is unusual for I guess more diehard Phish fans, but I love the records. Like, and it's because I love those songs. I mean, those songs completely they develop over years, and you know, some things like there are some songs you could play me a live version, and I could tell you like what era it's from. Because their styles change. Like 90, 92, 93, 94, Cray is like a shredder guitar player, like can fantastic, like so fast you wouldn't believe it. Listen to like a 93, like Roxy 93, fantastic. In 97, they go funk, they call it Cal Funk. In 2003, it's very, very, they call it the Oxy years because Trey was strung out on OxyContin, and it's all very atmospheric, very chastened. And you know, so there are definite eras to the band in terms of their sound, but and so people tend to always go to live shows, for a listening experience. And when I first got in, it was like, you can't listen to one song. You need to listen to a full show, and if not a full show, then a full set from the show. And I put in a lot of time doing that, and I'm at the point now where I think I'm good. I still listen to full shows, don't get me wrong, but I have like a playlist of the best jams, and yeah. So I mean, there's a ton of stuff. Oh, actually, if I could just backtrack one quick second,
Oh, go ahead.
just in terms of getting into Phish. When I decided that I was going to, that I thought I might like this stuff, I rented the Clifford Ball, which is the first festival they did in 96. It was a 7 DVD set from Netflix when they used to mail out DVDs.
Ah, the good
So
old
I like
days.
upped, yeah, I upped my subscription to like as many discs as you could take out. And I think I got them all at one time. If not, I got like four and four, but watched at least most of it in a weekend. And I was like, yeah, I'm completely in. And what I did, which got me in further, was when I found a track, and there were several that right off the bat like jumped out at me, and there were some I knew from listening to the podcast. If you go to fish.net and look up that song, it will give you a list of the best versions of that song and descriptions. And it was that I was like, okay, I'm starting with this song. It was David Bowie. Which is a song and a musical artist who's no longer with us. And I looked up on the jam chart, December 29th, 1994, Providence. They play a David Bowie, which gets very dark in the middle of it. It gets very quiet. There's a lot of whispering. There's a lot of ominous things being said. And the end of David Bowie is like a complete rager. So like right before that, there's this crazy creepy sequence, and I was like, that's gonna be the next one I listen to. So I bought that show from Live Fish, and that was it. I was like, I'm in. This is fantastic. And since then, just kept listening to shows and kind of just jumping like that. Like, now I'm gonna pick this song, look at the jam chart, see which ones they've released, and be like, that's the one I want to hear, and then just listen to that full show. And that's how I built all the listening. And to this day, like I do not, there's never a time where I can't put Phish on. Like it's there's so much of it, and so much of it has a different vibe that I usually listen to Phish during the workday. They're in the last, at least since pandemic, there haven't been many days that have gone by where I haven't listened to a full Phish show.
Oh, wow.
Usually I'll start one in the morning while I'm exercising, and then start work. So yeah, it's a crazy rabbit hole, but the most fun rabbit hole I've ever gotten into.
Nice. It's interesting to hear you say like you kind of did it like a song at a time, and I'm just kind of like, all right, let me give Rift a try. Let me give Picture an Extra a try. Let me give Billy Breathes a try. Let me give Joy a try. And just like those, and like I really did fall in love with those albums. They're fun to listen to. They make me happy, and they kind of remind me of. It's funny you said they remind you of Zappa. I hear a lot of like I grew up loving Southern rock. I hear a lot of Allman Brothers. I hear a lot of like early Charlie Daniels Band, even a little bit of Skynyrd, stuff like that. I hear that and they're playing, and I love that stuff. So when I hear like,
you should hear their a cappella. I was just gonna say, you should hear their a cappella version of Freebird, where Trey mouths the guitar solo.
Okay, that I need to hear. That sounds incredible.
Also, a fantastic a cappella band. They also do bluegrass. Like, there's a ton of shit they do.
Yeah.
I'm not a bluegrass guy, but I'll listen to Phish do bluegrass anytime. I love it. It's the best. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the reason I didn't go the route you did is because, like, I'd always heard for years, like, nobody listens to Phish albums. Like, we trade the tapes, and that's what people listen to. And the majority of it is that. But I do love the albums. I really do.
They are wonderful. I especially recommend, like, if everything we're talking about today seems scary to everybody, like, just go to your used CD store or used record store or whatever. Guarantee you're going to find a pretty cheap copy of Hoist or Billy Breathes or something like that. Just take it home. It'll be a nice way to ease into it, and then you can step in from there, like, however you want to do it. And I wanted to ask you, because, like, it clicked with me doing this whole thing back to the kind of like 70s Southern rock thing. Like, oh, that's why I clicked with these guys so hard, to the point that I was like, I got to send a song to Craig and see if he makes the same connection I did. I sent you a Charlie Daniels Band song, to which your response was, this better be good. I hate this racist fuck. Did you actually listen to the song?
I did. And I get it. Like, I can totally get that.
Yeah.
I can totally get that. And they do, I mean, they frequently do covers. And there are probably, like, Whipping Post is something that you've, like, their early shows from the 80s, they do Whipping Post.
Nice.
And that's the other thing that I think is amazing. Like, they have, Phish has, like, these epics that are coveted. And these days, you might get one or two, and well, you'll definitely get at least one usually, and those are like you enjoy myself, yeah. Like Slave to the Traffic Light, Run Like an Antelope, kind of like the big songs from the earlier days that tend to go a little bit longer. These shows, like from the 80s, where they're playing like, you know, like a state fair, and they're playing all of these fucking epics in one show in 1989, and you're like, those are college dudes who wrote these songs and are playing the same songs that are like completely coveted now. Like Rob, when I was getting in, Rob's like, yeah, I don't really listen to anything like pre-93, 94. So I avoided it. And then at some point I was like, I'm going to go back, because all these shows are available online. See the Zoo is a place you can get lossless copies. If you just Google Phish spreadsheet, there's a spreadsheet with an MP3 version of every show. You can find any show, and it's fine. They're cool with people taping, which is another reason I've always loved them, because I'm very into that. So, you know, just the fact that, you know, all that stuff's around, and the arrangements are so close to like what they became, like, and they're like practically kids. Like, it's crazy to me.
That's insane. And the fact that they still do a lot of those, like, those songs have survived. Even songs have survived that, like, it's like, you know, you said people say don't listen to the albums. There are songs that have never made a record that, like, people still freak out for. Like, one of my favorite songs we're going to talk about today, the only real recorded home it has is a live one, and that's about it. So that's an amazing piece of it too, I think. But
there are tons of people that are that way, even through to now. Like, even some songs they've debuted over the last few years that just didn't make the albums, that still kind of stayed in rotation, and some of their big ones like Mike's song Weekapog Groove, there are so many songs like that that are still like real big staples, like you'll get them every couple shows, whereas, you know, some of the stuff we'll be talking about today, or maybe next week, or maybe next month, depending on how long this goes, those songs have kind of gone to like once a year status, some of them, more in the rarer territory. So yeah. I feel like you asked a lot of questions, and I'm not sure I answered any of them because I'm so excited to talk about all of this that I just you wind me up and I go. So
It's perfect
you
though,
can
because you
feel free
answer
to tell me
like
to shut up, whatever.
you answer like three questions in the span of 10 minutes, so it's perfect.
Well then, mind reader,
Yeah,
listening to fish has done that for me.
there you go. Fit. It's like the fish mind meld.
There you go. I like it. I like it.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we've established like what like the history and kind of why people have weird feelings on the span, but I'm hoping with this podcast at least intrigue listeners out there. If you've never even like, considered like giving them a chance, just dip your toe in. Like you'll be surprised. Like go in like I did. Go in just like wanting to hear what this music is. That's really what I encourage you to do. Like
Yeah,
just
agreed.
try and put it aside and listen to Wikipod Groove as well. Go dig those episodes up because the excitement you and Rob have to talk about them is contagious as well. Like one of my favorite things to listen to still that I revisit a lot is the Baker's Dozen episodes. I love those. So good.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
So
That was maybe like the first big thing after I got into fish. That was the first big thing that happened. I think it was our first episode of Weekapod grew Weekapod. Now that I said Weekapod referring to the song,
Yep.
I have to go back to Weekapod.
Yeah.
I think it was our first episode where the Baker's Dozen shows were announced and we didn't know what they were going to be. So I think we're speculating a little bit in one of the earlier episodes, but essentially what they did was 13 nights at Madison Square Garden where they did not repeat a song. And every show was a different flavor of donut with some songs in each that would represent that. For example, Strawberry, open with Strawberry Fields Forever, an a cappella version. They also did Strawberry Letter 23 by Shuggie Otis. The Chocolate Night opened with them doing Chocolate
Chocolate
Rain
Rain.
by Hey Zonde, including them moving away from the mic to breathe. Incredible, incredible. And that's on YouTube. Look that up. It's hilarious.
It is.
But the
It's
best night, and this is one of the things that makes Fish great. They made right. I don't know what the phrase is. They made good. They made good on something they said as a joke in an interview like 20 years before, which was, we want to do like a Boston Cream show where we just do songs by Boston and Cream. So on Boston Cream night, they started playing Sunshine of Your Love, which at the most unexpected point went into More Than a Feeling, and the place goes ape shit. You're gonna have to insert that here. I'm gonna have to send it to you, and you're gonna have to insert it here. It's fantastic. It's those kind of things, and that was like there that was one of the things that like cemented it for me. I was like, why are bands not doing cool shit like this? Like maybe there are. The bands that I loved that claimed to be all about the fans did very little for the fans. Like and that's what I loved about Fish. Like they were actually like walking the walk. They were doing what other bands were like. They're putting the work in to like make a very unforgettable experience. Just to move, and I'm loath to bring this up, but there's a reason. Because I don't like talking about Kiss on podcasts because people always get mad at me when I do it and say that I can't stop talking about it. Usually when people just get me on and ask me about Kiss because they know they can wind me up and get me angry. But Megan, like I was Kiss fan for 40 years, and I'm not gonna piss on them. I'm just gonna say I jumped out when things started to get too embarrassing for me. But since 1996, in that entire span of time, I saw two great Kiss moments out of all the Kiss shows I saw. Both of them were on Kiss cruises. So it was close to maybe $10,000 for these two experiences. But I happened to pick the 2 years where they played a song from The Elder. The 2013, I got The Oath. I lost it. Went with Megan in 2017, and they encore with Rock and Roll All Night, as they are wont to do. And as we were getting ready to leave, they went into I, which I lost my skin mind. It was not enough. Like, they were not only doing a song from their most maligned album, they were doing it as the last song of an encore after their signature encore song. So it was like the biggest surprise they could spring on that audience. Maybe the best thing they ever did, in my opinion, that I saw at least. And Megan next to me, and she's told me this often. She's like, "I saw you in your absolute happiest moment." My friend Corey Nallen, also I've had him on Pod and Size Network, good friend, Fish fan, Kiss fan. I turned around and looked at him, and we were just like, are we really seeing this? It was just like a joyful moment with a bunch of people from a whole bunch of different countries. It was fantastic. But I wouldn't have gotten that experience at a regular Kiss show.
Right.
What Fish did on New Year's, even with me not being at that show, me sitting and watching the live stream hit me emotionally in a way that exceeded me seeing that Kiss show. And I'm not saying that because I'm no longer a Kiss fan or I walked away. I still appreciate them having done it, and I still love that I saw that. And I'm not pissing away the good moments I had because of, whatever made me walk away. But what I saw was just like Fish took what made that Kiss show special, and ratcheted it up a lot. And I was a mess. I was a mess. I won't send you the voice text that I was sending to Megan through it, where I'm crying, but because it'll be all over the internet tomorrow. But once you release it, all the people that are mad at me that I mock Kiss or look crying about Fish, but it was absolutely, and that's why this whole thing is so special. Like what it meant to, I can't imagine being in that room. Like, and I was on Reddit like throughout the whole thing. Just, I wanted to see what people were saying about it. And it was a lot of, I will never forgive myself for not being there, but oh my God, for everybody there, I'm so happy for you, which is like what fandom, it's the great thing about fandom. Like you're missing out, but you're happy for everybody that saw it.
Right,
And I
it's
think
the
that anybody that watched it felt the same. Like I completely chills now thinking about it. I haven't watched it since without getting emotional. It's that crazy. If you would have told me 10 years ago that anything Fish could do could make me emotional, I would have squarely hit you in the sack because I would never have believed it. But I saw a band with a huge history take that history and give their fans the one thing they wanted most after so long, 29 years. So that's what makes this special. I wanted to kind of get that out before we, if we ever dive into the track by
Right.
track.
We'll get there. We'll get there. I've got one thing I wanted to say kind of based on that. Then we could jump into like the track by track and like kind of the amp up to Gamehenge itself.
Sure.
Like I just want to say you brought up Kiss first. I was gonna avoid it because I have my little anger a kiss right now, like, because I mean, not that the Avatar thing is unexpected, but like, I'll save that rant for another episode I'm doing. But the point is, the thing I think I'm getting from all this, like, especially kind of what I've seen from Fish over the years, is that, you know, doing the Boston Cream thing or doing the Baker's Dozen, opening with Chocolate Rain, these are moments that could very easily, if not executed well, or if the audience that night isn't into it, it could go over like a lead balloon, essentially. But they're not afraid of that. They're willing to take a risk, see what happens, and maybe look a little silly in the process. Kiss will never play the Oath or I on, so like, not on the water, because they are just afraid of not having that moment. Whereas Fish is like, well, we're going to have a moment. Maybe it'll be a weird moment, but it'll be a moment. And I think that's admirable. I think that makes things a lot more special. So, yeah.
I can give you a perfect example of them falling flat on their face, and it's sad because it could have been a great moment. I'm talking about Fish.
Yeah.
On the lemon night of the Baker's Dozen, they played Everything in Its Right Place by Radiohead, because the first line is, "Yesterday I woke up sucking a lemon." And when it starts, you hear the crowd realize they are covering Radiohead. Holy shit. And Fishman sings it, which was not a good idea.
Really?
And it's kind of rough. Did you hear it?
I just, I'm imagining it, and I'm like, oh,
yeah. It's I think Paige could have done it. I think they were going for something where, I mean, there is kind of like a comic relief in Fishman doing something. I mean, his gag is to, like, you know, come out to the front of the stage in his muumuu and, you know, blow into a vacuum as a musical instrument and sing a Syd Barrett song. Like his, and that, you know, that's something that happens, you know, not as much anymore, but in the early days, every couple shows. Or like he would do like Cracklin' Rosie, or, you know, just a weird kind of like 70s cover or something. I think having him sing it kind of took a little bit of the heaviness off it. Whereas, like, if we're like playing this Radiohead song and we don't do it well, it's going to be bad. So let's, and I don't know that this is what they were thinking, but like, it makes sense to me. Like, let's have Fishman do it. It'll kind of take a little bit of the pressure off in terms of maybe like seriousness of the whole thing, which is not to say they played it in a mocking fashion. They didn't. He was not the vocalist for it at that time. So that was a moment where, in the last episode I did with Rob, we were talking about that. And I was like, he had mentioned something about, you know, something that happens where just the room is deflated. And I was like, Everything in Its Right Place. And he's like, exactly what I was thinking. I think he was at that show and like actually experienced it live and was like, oh man, this could have been, and it's even worse, like on tape, if you're not there. So it's like, if you're in the room, it's like, oh cool, I'm seeing this. But if you're listening to it on tape, it's like, yeah, maybe they didn't pull this one off. And I'm fine with that. Yeah. You know, not everything is going to work, you know?
But yeah, that is, I might look that up too, just out of morbid curiosity.
I'm sure it's on YouTube.
I'm sure
there's an audience recording of it on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. This is going to be an epic episode. All right.
It
so
is. You might want to split this one between our discussion and the track by track, because there are, you know, I would think that there might be people that might enjoy the discussion and not care about the track by track. And maybe that's the place to split it. I don't know.
And that, friends and listeners, is where we will break for part two. If you want to hear the rest of this multi-beast of an episode, tune in the coming weeks, where we will get into the track-by-track discussion of the game Henge performance and piece, as well as the history of the piece. It's very fascinating. Thanks again to Craig for doing this. This is a lot of fun. Until next time, I'm the Sly Dog. Peace, love, rock and roll. Fish, play us out.
Listening to the Sly Dog Music Cast. If you want to know what's going on, follow me on Twitter at Sly Dog Music Cast or Facebook at Sly Dog Music Cast. Thanks again for listening. Peace, love, and music.